Welcome to This Week in FX PhD, your weekly wrap-up and behind the scenes at fxphd.com.
Hi, and welcome to This Week at FX PhD. John Montgomery with you. A bit under the weather, but how are you doing, my friend?
I'm actually really well. Sorry you're not, but I am.
Yeah, just I don't know. I'm just sad. I had a nice weekend, a 3-day weekend here. I had the Martin Luther King Jr. Day on Monday, and that's all well and good. But boy, I hit a wall. So forgive us if this podcast is a bit short, but we wanted to get it done today because, well, it's important.
Yeah, absolutely.
So how's everything down under? You had a shoot this week, didn't you?
Yeah. We're shooting for DIP. We're doing an audio shoot primarily, and so the emphasis on that was to get some good dialogue, good interaction going between the actors, and then record it, not only how we would record it, but record it on a couple of different mics at the same time so we could cut between the audio. So we don't normally do that, and to do that where you were recording like on 6 or 8 channels simultaneously. So that's good because that's one of the things that you kind of got to get a little bit of effort to do these days. It's easy enough to record 2 channels, but recording 8 channels and being able to jump between these 2 sets of mics and these 2 sets of mics and these. And I got to say, I was learning a bunch of stuff. Some of it is like, you know, you go into these things, John, and you think, well, I kind of know the territory we're going to cover because you plan it.
Yeah.
But in the middle of it, the guy we had from Rode was like, so these are the soundboards. He goes, yeah, those are those expensive sound panels, aren't they? And I went, yeah, we got those and it's really good and we put them on the board. He goes, how are you finding that? I said, well, pretty good. We'd like them to be better. You know, how could we place them better? And he's like, I wouldn't use them. And I'm like, what? He goes, yeah, those are kind of expensive. And I think he said it off air. He was like, it's kind of like they sell that to people that have more money than sense kind of thing. What do you actually want to get? And I'm like, what? Back up. So as you'll hear in the class, he comes up with the $20 vastly better solution. And I was like, oh, well, where were you when I was buying these stupid things?
Yeah, exactly.
Jeez. So anyway.
I love the Rode guys. I'm really use the headset mic all the time that we ended up having after NAB 1 year. And really great quality, lightweight. You can hardly see it on camera, those really small ones. And then the lapels are very nice in addition to that. And I like the Rode kind of interconnect kit that you can get that allows you flexibility for plugging into various types of plugs and so forth. That's also kind of smart. I guess it's an added cost, one could argue, but it does provide a bit of flexibility as well.
Yes. Well, Rode may or may not be coming out with some new stuff soon. And when they may or may not be coming out with some new stuff soon, we can do some more that'll also go into the second class we're doing on audio. But I like Rode. And here's the thing. It isn't an ad for Rode. Like, we don't go through the Rode, you know, set of gear. It's just that if you've got somebody that really – the guy who's – Clint who's doing it for Rode used to be a DOP. So our emphasis is on, like, sound for an indie film. So he knows from a DOP's point of view, this is what matters to me, as opposed to just being, well, I'm a guy from Rode and this is a really good mic if you're recording your band. I'm like, okay, but I'm not recording a band. I'm shooting a film, so. So, yeah.
Well, we'll look forward to that as part of the class.
Yes. So I believe Rode is doing that announcement in San Diego. But the announcement that they may or may not be doing on...
I believe it's pronounced San Diego, at least according to Ron Burgundy.
Well, excuse me.
I've been having some fun putting together, been doing some editing, tweaking on the flame classes that Scott's doing. They're not coming out yet, but Scott is kind of focusing on particles. I filmed some stuff of me out, and I think we talked about the first week, but starting to dive into that and picked up some quick tips even from his first class as well. So I'm looking forward to those. I know those people who signed up for the flame course and were really interested in, and Scott was interested in everything, but there hasn't been a lot of particle stuff. And it's kind of interesting because I think that, Mike, a discussion of particles is actually how I first really ended up meeting you virtually, so to speak. I posted on Flame News asking about a particle question.
Yeah, we were doing particles in flame back in the day, and it was. And then, well, I think that may have been the initial email, but I think it quickly changed to the broader tips and tricks that...
online dating, yeah, things like that, yeah.
What?
Yes, no. Did I mention I'm a bit under the weather? But it went into effects how we met the user group meeting, but then, I've started doing tips and tricks, turned into effects guide, DVD guide. That was part of FX Guide for a while.
Well, yeah, the thing about it is that particles can add enormous production value, and it's amazing sometimes when you don't pay attention to particles. They're actually relatively simple. I mean, they're not super simple, but they're not the most complicated thing in the world, but they just add that extra thing that just, you know, brings something alive. I'm a big exponent of being able to do that, and so that's why it was good doing it in flame, because it was the last minute, as it were, the last stage. You know, you weren't at a sort of a planning stage where it's a major particle effect. It's more like you're adding those things in that help sell the shot and make it more interesting. And sometimes just literally, I can remember a guy doing some KFC, no, McDonald's commercials, and it was, you know, like some kind of Happy Meal. I was like, well, let's just put some pixie dust in. Like, well, I haven't got time to do that. So I'll just do it now. And, yeah, it was just, it's not necessarily the biggest thing in the world, but man, it can apply.
No, that's the thing about it. And, you know, frankly, that hasn't progressed or changed much in the years since we were just talking about when we first posted that question to Flame News, where I did. But the fact is that's where these classes kind of come into play, is how you might sensibly use these within Flame. And of course, I joke a little bit about that, because they've actually added a extreme, you know, large number of particle presets that help kind of break that down. Yeah, I mean, you know, I was saying that kind of jokingly. The undercore, the underpinnings of that is still very much the same, but they did introduce that to make it more approachable, and that's the idea. It's not designed to do, you know, obviously.
Just FYI, though.
Yeah.
The first time I saw particles at the discrete offices before it was released as a product, and they showed them to me, and I literally, the first thing I said is, oh my god, but it would be really great to have a bunch of presets for this, because like take
how many years later
and they were like, well, but you just do it like this. I'm like, yeah, no, but it would be just so cool if you had a library. Just call out, so, well, you could make a library,
yeah,
and it would be really good if you had a library. So, yeah, no, it's
exactly 15 years later. Yes, exactly. But no, and so that's what comes into play, is that kind of last minute tweaks. In my case, it's adding some breath and a bit of snow and things like that. Yep. It's not designed to do what's happening in the real flow course or anything like that with sims and whatsoever. But it's, again, a tool for the job kind of thing, I think. So it's a lot of fun. It's been fun to check out what he's been doing. And his approach also, I just, again, know Flame so well. It's always interesting to watch someone else work.
Oh, yeah.
We used to do these little Flame jam sessions between a group of us, Jeff Huser and Jake and Wally and Peter and MB. And, you know, it was always fun to kind of see how other people worked. You always pick up a tip or two. So that was actually a lot of fun.
Well, it was fun, but it was also incredibly intimidating, because if you pause but for a second to gather your – people go, the button's on the right. You know, I know what the button is.
I know.
It's like having, you know, like a uber bunch of experts looking over your shoulder. And that was a good uber bunch of experts.
Yeah, it is. It's a friendly, intimidating bunch, I guess. You know, not adversarial intimidating, but just, you know, just a lot of people who know what they're doing. So, yeah, that was a lot of fun. So that's been fun on my standpoint. Also, pushed some changes and, you know, further tweaks to the site to speed it up over the weekend again. Updated some stuff under the hood. Probably stuff that you guys who are members won't notice as much, though. I did notice a bug that was accidentally filling in your support request with the wrong email. It was not anyone hacking in. There was just some caching going on. People were worried that their passwords had been compromised, but no, basically it was my name in it that was stuck in the caching mechanism. So we fixed that as well. That's probably the one that anyone would notice, and I mentioned that only because a couple people dropped into support and mentioned that as well. Again, nothing wrong, nothing harmless, just, you know, invalid cache, and I think we all know from having invalid caches and being rendered into comps in the past how painful that can be. but not quite as painful online. So did that over the weekend. Also, we've got the those of you who are members in our last term have the end of term survey is ready to go out, and that's going out this week. And Mike, and bring that up because we really do. Listen to the survey and pay a lot of attention to that, and it plays an incredibly critical role in planning future courses. I got to say that many of the courses we have come not only from the Epic course suggestion thread, but also just consideration of people who post in the survey, because not everyone posts in the forums, not everyone does in the survey, so it's a combination of these two things that goes into our planning. So when that survey comes out, please take the time to do it. It's really fast. It's under 5 minutes. Maybe even 2 or 3 minutes, I guess, to get that done. That'll be out this week by Wednesday, probably, or Thursday if you're down in Mike's neck of the woods.
Yeah, yeah. It's really good. We do the surveys, and it's not because like the surveys are valid every time. So if you've done one before, it's not like, oh, well, I did one before, because we're trying to track and see how things move from term to term. So you can take the time. It would be great. I had somebody once say to me, well, I did a survey. I said, well, yeah, but we okay. And that's great. We appreciate it. Thank you. But if you can do it again, that would be even better.
Yeah, because, again, it also provides feedback as to actually courses that we run, how often we repeat the course, whether it's worthwhile to repeat a course, things like that. So that's the other aspect that we use of it. It's not simply to plan future courses and make sure we're doing things the right way. There's plenty of room to comment on things regarding that, but it's also to determine what ends up being shown in part of our standard course repeats or the vault repeat as well. So it helps us determine that to get your feedback. I mean, we have our perception of the classes and our ideas of what we want to do and see. But I think hearing from you guys directly is much better. Exactly. Of really, you guys are why we're doing this. So that's why it's incredibly important. We have our ideas, but we use them to your input to either confirm or reject those ideas, frankly.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, a couple of things I wanted to flag, if I could. We've just published an interview with Don Shea. Don's stepped down from Cinefx. It's over at FX Guide, number 288 of our FX podcast. We've done a couple of these now. And I have to say, one of them we did 10 years ago was with Don Shea. And so that was on the 25th anniversary of Cinefx, and rightly so. So here we are, 35 years since he started the magazine, and he's leaving. And I think that... I just feel like a debt of gratitude to him. So I was super plussed that he agreed to do an interview, even though he was there was no false modesty, but he was literally trying to not make any fuss about him leaving. And I was, as you'll hear in the interview, like, well, forget that.
Yeah, I mean, that magazine just had such an impact on me and my desire to be in the industry. Really the magazine of record for so much work over the years, and have such respect for what he's done and built. I mean, it really dramatically furthered my interest in visual effects. I could not wait to get my hands on the most recent Cinefx. There was one magazine store in town, the Book Nook, on the Book Corner, on the corner of the square in downtown Bloomington where I grew up. And I would, go in there about the time that they were supposed to come out religiously every day, ride my bike down there to see if it came out. That's how into it I was.
Yeah. And so I think it's a passing of the baton from Don to Greg Shea, and Greg's done a great job. But that being said, somebody's made that kind of contribution for for 35 years. I don't think you should be able to step away from the microphone without having a round of applause.
Exactly.
Because he's a really nice guy, and he's grown up with the industry. Like, it's just so funny to me that when he started, they were like really scratching around to find three films that had special effects in them to write the thing about. Mm-hmm. Today, every film has special effects in it, of course. And you just can't imagine a time when it was like, well, are there any films that we could actually do a story about? Because there just aren't that many. So, yeah. He actually came out post-Star Wars, but as you'll hear in the interview, sort of because of Star Wars. I always think that it covered, of course, the second and the third Star Wars, but it didn't actually ever cover the original Star Wars, because it was some work that Don did off the original Star Wars that led to the magazine actually happening. So I didn't know that, and I thought I knew everything that was to know about Cinefx. So that's one thing I want to mention. The other thing was I just want to say they were robbed that the guys on LEGO did not get a nomination for Best Animated Film. We talked about that in the podcast last week, and I just assumed it would be down between Big Hero 6 and LEGO. But not for a second did I think LEGO would not get a nomination. So to all our friends at Animal Logic, you totally deserve to be nominated. I don't care what anybody says about slights and snubs, and I'm not doing it for any other reason than I just genuinely thought. I'm willing to accept that whoever wins is a bit of a popularity competition, but the nominations should be from the peers, and the peers should have put LEGO up there. Yeah, said my piece.
I agree with that.
I hope so.
not being a... Yes, I certainly agree with that.
Animal Logic, nice guys. And, of course, they were in FX Guide number 200, where we were focusing on the skill of animators. So, I'm not just saying that because I was thinking that way beyond. I just think that art of getting character into an animated character, giving them weight and presence and humor and life. That's just one of the great skills of our industry. And I have enormous respect for people that do that. And so, yeah, they deserved it.
There's another cool article that Mike just posted and the team in Sydney's been working on over the last couple of months, and that's the FX PhD, I guess, a member showreel.
Yeah.
Very, very cool. It's right now, it's the main post on the production blog. This is actually at the end of last term, or middle to end of last term, put out a request here on the DoD, actually, for those who've been listening, as well as in the forums, asking for submissions for the reel. And I think it really turned out great. Some really outstanding work on the show reel, some fun behind the scenes stuff about what FXPHD is all about as well, stuff that's been on set and things like that. And my tribute to show reel and past technology with Isha, the 2-inch quad machine as the poster frame of the
Yeah, I noticed that.
It's a bit of an inside joke, I think, to those of us who've been around for a bit longer.
Is that actually a 2-inch machine? I thought it was like an early 1-inch. That's a 2-inch under about a mountain of dust.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, that was from the old, that was in the basement of the old FXPHD Chicago offices, our first offices that we moved into with the folks at Hootenanny, Liz, and actually in the same building where they, that's been used for production for, 50 or 60 years. So they had all this old gear piled in stacks in the basement that they just hauled out in trucks, but really some amazingly gorgeous old gear and tubes and things like that, stuff that no longer abandoned and no longer used. So pretty interesting, I thought.
Do you still have a lot of digibetas from like when you were?
Yeah.
And what do you think you're going to do with those?
I don't know. They're just going to sit in my basement back in Chicago where they are now. I think actually maybe I have. Someone did actually make the trip, but no, most of those have been archived off to some digital format. It's actually now the problem of they were archived off onto DVD, and then they were archived off onto exabyte.
Exabyte,
and now LTO. So far, we're so good on LTO. So,
you know, the thing is about those, I was like thinking, obviously when we're doing FXPHD, well, I'll keep these because they're great reference for this, that, and the other thing. But of course, my Beta cams are digital beta cams, standard def. So these days we never put anything out that's, sort of that low res. So even if I had really good reference of something, apart from a conceptual reference, like this is what we're trying to do, none of the image quality is sort of, I guess you could up-res it and stuff, but it's just, I was like, oh yeah, it's all standard def. And then worse is I've got some really great stuff that's D1, like from like effects reels of, lasers and sort of vapor traily things, the sort of things that you would use to, if you're doing an episodic sci-fi show, all on D1, all unable to be read by anyone because no one has a D1 machine.
Well, yeah.
So
see, the 2-inch, the photo of the quad machine was appropriate there at the beginning. Actually, one thing I just remembered, speaking of really old footage, did I ever tell you that the Zapruder film was actually developed in that building? The footage of Kennedy was actually developed in the building that Liz and I were in.
I'm sorry, what?
The Zapruder film that was of Kennedy's assassination
was
actually developed in that building.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
According to local legend, I'm not quite sure. Well, that's where there was a production company in there, or a development company. The tape actually first aired, the film first aired on a Chicago television station. So it was developed there in Chicago, and in theory, it was developed in that building. Yeah, obviously that might not be true, but that's the history of that building, I guess you could say.
Well, there you go. Anyway, that is a 2-inch
fun fact.
It looks like
I don't know, it was a quad machine as well, just for those of you who are.
I like the fact that back in the day, before you and I were in the industry, and they had analog tape, one of the ways that was tried and vaguely used for dubbing material was to run a second piece of tape right next to the first piece of tape. And the magnetic charge was so strong on the first piece of tape that it would align the second piece of tape the same way, and it would be contact dubbing through tape. And I was told that story, and I swear to God, I still believe it. And if someone reckons that I've been taken for a ride, but I argued with the guy who was basically not a comical kind of engineering guy, that that's something that actually happened like 40 years ago or whatever, when they first had videotape. And I was like, to this day, I've just often pondered, well, not often pondered, but occasionally pondered, would that actually work? Could you actually contact Dub Magtope? You ever heard of that?
No.
Okay, I'm pretty sure it's true. It's a rare. Sure.
Okay, well, you know what?
You think I'm being duped, right?
Yeah, not duped.
It's a duped story. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly.
Now I say it out loud. It does sound a bit far-fetched, but I'm pretty sure it's true. Anyway, let's see. Here we go. Those engineers, in fact, those archival companies that are obviously in business for the purposes of solving the problems that we're just discussing. In other words, somebody has some very important footage that was on a format that is no longer supported. The engineers that are the engineers that really understand this stuff have aged with the gear, and there isn't a younger generation necessarily take their place. So it's an interesting area, that kind of understanding the older tech stuff, is that, you know, instead of being useless because you understand the older tech, they're actually quite in demand in some areas, certainly here in Australia. If you have engineering skills in that area and you aren't retired, then you know, it's really quite easy to get a job, because there is all this material. It's really, really valuable, and every once in a while someone wants to refer to it. And yeah, it's not immediately obvious how you do it.
No, and it's actually interesting, because there's a discussion going on in one of the groups I'm involved with on people who are providing, you know, digital masters at post houses. So, you know, you instead of sending over tape as you used to do for your master, you're sending over digital files nowadays. And here in the States, and in many places, but there's still very much this, while things have been upgraded digital, the news broadcasts on local stations are generally HD and they're on camera, but there's still a significant standard definition infrastructure in these various facilities that are being utilized, whether it's even that standard def being broadcast in digital form, but there's still that resolution and interlacing. And what's happening, Mike, is as some of these old school and old timer, I'll say, but older people who have that knowledge of the old analog television days, they're few and far between, or fewer and far between. And what's happening is there's things that are happening at stations where we'll provide a technically correct, or people provide a technically correct video master that includes interlacing, which will, of course, broadcast okay. But if you look at it on your screen, or you look at that movie on your screen, you see this interlacing looks like a bunch of artifacts, right? Because it's not intended. It's not an interlaced display. Well, these spots are getting rejected because of digital artifacts. And they're like, what are the digital artifacts? Well, there's like these lines in along the stuff that's moving fast. And you're like, that's interlacing. So, and
wow, that's even way worse than I thought.
And so one of the stories and discussions was that it actually went so far that they were like, well, how are you speccing these? You know, and like, well, he's looking at it on the PC, not even looking at it on a broadcast monitor, not looking at it. You know, if you're going to technically, if you want to really spec a spot, you have scopes and you look at a broadcast monitor. I mean, a very few out there probably that support interlacing, but that's another story. But that's what's happening, is there's this whole school of this whole range of people now new to the industry that frankly haven't needed to really worry about that. You know, I mean, many of the artists that we trained over the years and later at Avenue Edit actually didn't really need to know many of the things that you had to deal with originally, like analog scopes and things like that. You just, that wasn't generally something you had to deal with. And that's even now hitting that in broadcast, where frankly, you still need to worry about that. So anyway, there's a huge, it's kind of an interesting tie to what we're talking about, but it's there's a lack of that engineering expertise, I guess, even now at starting to happen at TV stations that are still reliant on old technology.
Hmm. At the other end of the spectrum, changing the subject completely, I was really interested to see, and I haven't actually talked about this, that The Interview made 40 million online on demand. So skipping tape, skipping film, skipping broadcasting, skipping theatres, because, of course, of the problems of what happened. And I'm not commenting on The Interview as a quality of the film, but it's just stunning to me that we've now got distribution in a distributed online environment of a tune that's like real money, you know? Like, I think this is going to go down as a significant turning point in the industry, that we can now look at having a film that can rake in, you know, tens of millions of dollars without ever having been in theatres much. I mean, it was in theatres, wasn't it? Just
a very limited run, yes.
Yeah, but it's primarily just... Now, it's maybe a unique case because it's not press about it, but
right.
I mean, you know, if you can, and apparently I haven't seen the film. Apparently it's not that good. I mean, the best thing about it was that it got a bump by Korea, but it's still a remarkably big number for, you know, direct to video. Because remember, direct to DVD or direct to video used to be like the kiss of death for anything in any respect. You know, you'd be lucky to make anything out of it. And now it's still a way unprofitable film in the sense that it's cost $75 million to make.
Mm-hmm.
But if you could make something closer to, you know, $20 million and make $40 million online, well, now we're really kicking it. And I can't imagine that it would be impossible to make for that to happen in the next, you know, few years. And once that happens, I mean, that's kind of pretty weird for the distributors and the studios. I mean, will the studios embrace that, or will they like be really nervous about it? I don't know.
Well, I think the studios are obviously nervous to do anything to disrupt at this point in time their traditional distribution models, especially when, you know, at least in the States, there are, you know, relatively few major chains out there. But I'm curious, are you aware of what the take is for the studios, like what's the comparison and how much money they make on this on-demand versus a studio release or a theater release?
Yeah, great question. And I don't know. I would estimate, not having the facts in front of me, that they would make more from direct to...
Me too. That's what I would think.
Yeah, because like let's say you put something up on iTunes, you're going to have a 30% clip on the ticket. So now getting stuff out to a cinema... is going to be way more than 30% because you have the problem of the fees to the actual place that, you know, sold the popcorn.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to be taking money. There's a lot of other costs between there and the, which you just don't have on this stuff. So if you could get all your distribution costs down to 30% or lower, you know, you're keeping 3/4 of the money. So on 40 million, you're keeping 30 million. And of course, we all know that the first run at this stage isn't all the money. There's quite a long tail on movies, so they'll make more money in other places. That being said, I don't imagine it'll double or triple or whatever, but it's not that this film in of itself is, it's just that kind of money for a direct distribution. I mean,
it was an unfortunate test, I guess, experiment, right? I mean, that's not the way you want to have that to happen, but it is an interesting case study for sure from that standpoint.
Like, you can't imagine a studio making a film with bankable lead stars that is of the order of the $75 million budget that this had going this way unless something incredibly extraordinary happened, which is exactly what happened. And that gives us this very unique, sort of, for the time being, one-off little peek at what might be happening. But it can't be missed that, you know, 40 million, and it's still clicking. I mean, I don't know about you, but when I go to iTunes, I see the interview on, you know, it's one of the films they're kind of recommending.
Right.
So let's say it's going to do 50 mil or whatever before it's finished. But those are reasonable numbers. I mean, maybe there is a, you know, a way to produce. I could imagine an artist who, or director, you know, kind of a, somebody that's got indie cred but also makes big blockbuster films, and when they're not making their big blockbuster, they make that smaller film where the actors, you know, like the kind of classic Woody Allen model where very high quality people doing it much more for rates, and it isn't a big effects thing, and that going straight out. And that film is harder to make these days. It's not tentpole. It's you know, harder to get out unless it's got Oscar buzz.
Yeah.
Because the other extraordinary thing that's happened is how much the U.S. has responded to The Sniper since we spoke last. Oh, my God, it's just an amazing box office.
Yeah.
But yeah, so unless you've got some real juice and around Oscar time, there are that occasion where small films get that. Yeah, man, 40 million. A lot of people would be really happy with that as a kind of a... But maybe it's only because it was just so controversial. Maybe it wouldn't otherwise happen.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it goes a long way to paying off the production costs, that's for sure. No question.
Well, I think for our community, the FX PhD community, I think a lot of people would love to see a non-studio pathway to having more independent releases. I think that's something that's come up a lot, and we've had PhD meetups at shows and done that kind of stuff with people.
Yeah, certainly interesting. Certainly interesting. Well, my friend, I better go. I'm kind of fading here. I have
I'm
to
sorry to hear
say,
that.
it's okay.
No, keep going. I'm going to keep talking.
Well, thanks everyone for taking the time to listen, and we really appreciate it. As always, if you have any questions, we've asked you guys in the past, but go ahead and post in the forums. If you have any topics or things you'd like us to talk about on the podcast, please do that, or just drop us a line via email, and we'd love to include it as part of the DoD. But until next time, we'll see you in the forums. Bye.
See you guys.
Thanks for listening. This podcast is copyright FX PhD.